AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the best of the English and Irish, Oscar nominee actresses Kerry Condon and Felicity Jones talk to me about their role in the gorgeous new film on Netflix, Train Dreams, as well as keeping their accents and planting trees. Wicked for Good, the second part of the Wicked epic, is on the big screen this weekend, and Chris Rosser tells us if it's worth the hype. And of course, all the TV you'll want to stream or skip. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And I do hope you are doing well. So last week, I said to you that, you know, the most intriguing piece of TV I'd watched all week was Ireland v Portugal. And I invoked Darth Vader and said how I'd, you know, felt a presence I hadn't felt for in a long time when he senses Obi-Wan Kenobi. Talking about the joy we were feeling, some of us anyway, in a sense of maybe the future was bright and that we might be going to a World Cup or something like that. And then Sunday happened. And I know this is a film show and a TV show, but the TV that mattered the most this week to me and to over a million people, it seems, was Ireland's match against Hungary. And look, you've heard it all week long, and it's almost platitudinous at this stage. But my gosh, what a 96 or 7 minutes that was. Now, the funny thing is, you know, if I'm being honest, you know, you're not really going to describe 94 minutes of it as enjoyable, you know, because it was a mix of quiet hope, followed by devastating depression, followed by another bit of quiet hope. Then that came into bloom. And then the third goal was just, you know, up there with my memory of sitting in a classroom in Donegal in a summer Gaeltacht, watching Paddy Bonner save a goal and then a nation holding its breath. I think this is the second greatest footballing TV moment I have witnessed. And the whole family were in the room watching. And that involves certainly one child who has no interest in football. But even she was watching. And it's funny, my 13-year-old afterwards said he felt funny after it. And I did too. Like, I felt drained watching it. It was like a marathon or something. And you know me, I like to talk about running marathons. But by golly, it was just terrific, terrific TV. So I just have to start by saying that's the TV that I was watching the most last week, and roll on March. And listen, there's a rumor on the channels, Troy Parrott, the greatest living Irishman at the moment, may be going to Everton in January. So watch this space. Anyway, to more pedestrian TV, but nonetheless great TV, take a listen to this.
We come from a showbiz family.
And now the comedy house.
Stiller and Mira.
Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira.
Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller.
We grew up around them, working together and improvising, and that's what we did, because they did it.
You're looking at not only my partner in comedy, this is the mother of my two kids.
This is the father of one.
When they were working, I remember sometimes hearing laughter, sometimes hearing raised voices, never knowing if that was real or them rehearsing something.
We don't know, Ben. That's why we're so messed up.
Yeah, no, that is a clip. Hopefully you recognize the voice of Ben Stiller in there. It's from a show or a documentary on Apple TV that was out 2 or 3 weeks ago called Stiller and Mira, Nothing Is Lost. And in this, Ben Stiller has created a gorgeous documentary, I have to say, of him cleaning out his mum and dad's apartment with his sister. And that might not seem like that great source material, but when you realize that his parents were Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. And they were this comedy duo in the 60s and 70s and indeed 80s that were quite successful and were on Johnny Carson and all those kind of things and did stage shows. And then later on, Jerry Stiller, Ben's dad, became very well known because of Seinfeld, where he played George Costanza's dad. And in this, we have Ben Stiller with his sister looking back at their life and times, going through their belongings. And his dad had kind of photographed and filmed an awful lot of stuff. So there's a huge archive here. But aside from that, his parents were complicated people. They were a showbiz couple who loved each other, but there was a strange dynamic at times. And how could there not be, you know, knowing where the act ended and the marriage begun? And in a way, Jerry Stiller, Ben's dad, nearly admits this. She was the senior partner, maybe, Ann Mira, in terms of talent. You get that kind of feeling that it came more natural to her, certainly, whereas Jerry Stiller had to work hard on it. And Ben Stiller and his sister, you know, they had a slightly complicated childhood because of their parents. They were complicated parents, even though they loved them, but the act got in the way a bit and they were, you know, missing from them, even though they were loving to them. It was a complicated childhood they had as a result of having these famous parents. And what I really liked about this is that Ben Stiller, you know, we talked about Eddie Murphy's documentary last week, which a couple of people talked to me about and agreed with me. They thought it was a puff piece, but still loved it because it was so exciting in places. But it was a puff piece. This is not a puff piece because Ben Stiller is quite honest and he doesn't go really in depth, but he has his own two children in it. Well, he does go pretty in depth about how he may have made the same mistakes as his own parents. And his two kids talk in this, they're kind of young adults, about how he was missing in action sometimes and flying home from Night of the Museum 3. And he's kind of melancholic about how he kind of screwed up as a dad and as a husband, because his wife, who's an actress as well, is in this. And they split up and then they got back together. And she talks about his missingness, his absence is probably a better word, Christine Taylor, the actress. So I really liked how Stiller was brave enough to kind of present himself as far from the perfect dad at times. He comes across kind of sad and, you know, unresolved, not having found closure and putting it out there. It's quite refreshing. But aside from that, it's also a fascinating portrait of his parents' marriage and the effect it has on him and indeed his sister. And that, you know, I often use that phrase, in circles we move, but how sometimes it seems we're destined to repeat the things we've experienced, even though they might not be healthy, but the patterns we're given in childhood, you know, I'm turning into Freud here, but they do repeat themselves. And Ben Stiller becomes aware of this on film to us. So I think it's a great watch. It's called Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost. It's on Apple TV. It's an hour and 50 minutes. A lovely, lovely, honest watch. Now, last week we were raving about All Her Fault. A couple of weeks ago, I was raving about Task and on Sky. All Her Fault is also on Sky. And, you know, you can't rave about TV every week and say this is the best thing in ages, but we've kind of got a trio of great shows because there was a show that landed on Netflix last week called The Beast in Me, starring Claire Danes. And by golly, it's brilliant. It's 8 episodes. I'm only 4 in, but I'm telling you, folks, it's one of the best shows of the year. And I know I'm saying that lately, but it's the truth. So we have Claire Danes playing Aggie Wiggs. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning writer who's kind of trapped in grief. She's lost her son, basically, who was killed by a drunk driver about 6 years ago, and he got away with it. And she's living in a place called Oyster Bay in Long Island. And she's writing a book about the Supreme Court judge, Bader Ginsburg, and the other one, Antonio Scalia, and how they had an unlikely friendship. And there's a feeling this book isn't going anywhere. And she's in a bit of a rut. And then she becomes fascinated by her new neighbour, a man called Niall Jarvis, played brilliantly by Matthew Rhys. And he's this real estate mogul, and he's notorious because there's a suspicion he may have murdered his wife. And what I really like about this is that, you know, if it was a different type of show, it would take a long time for Claire Danes' character to rub up against Matthew Rhys's. But they meet really early in this. He has some dogs that come around her house and scare the bejesus out of her dog and indeed her. And they meet pretty much as the series begins. And she doesn't know what to make of him. He wants to build a jogging track in a forest that all the neighbors share. And she wants nothing to do with this. Yet he's intriguing her because he starts giving her advice on the next book she should write and all that kind of stuff. We also have the character of an FBI agent who had investigated the case who shows up at her house. So I don't want to say too much more. This is great. I'm repeating myself from last week with all her fault, but this is a brilliant watch that is going to grip you. It really is. And Claire Danes, I mean, she does that Claire Danes thing we've come to know of furrowed brow and looking distressed, but she does it very well. And the relationship between her and this guy, Niall Jarvis, is brilliant. It's 8 episodes. It's on Netflix, I should say. The Beast in Me. By golly, folks, if you finished All Her Fault and you're looking for your next binge, I'm telling you, you won't be disappointed with The Beast in Me. Let me know what you might have been watching. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. After the break, I'm going to be talking to Felicity Jones and Kerry Condon about all sorts of things, but most importantly, about their new film, Train Dreams. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, have a listen to a flavour of this beautiful film.
Beautiful, ain't it?
What is?
I didn't think you'd be on this, sir.
Well, I just couldn't stop walking until I got here.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking that we ought to get married.
This is rough work, gentlemen. Not just on the body. We just cut down trees that have been here for 500 years. Upsets a man's soul whether he recognizes it or not.
You think that she knows that I'm her daddy?
Deep down, she knows it. Even if she doesn't know, she knows it yet.
Yes, that is a clip from Train Dreams, which was in cinemas for the last few weeks, but lands on Netflix this weekend, Friday, the 21st of November. It's directed by Clint Bentley, and it's based on a novella by Dennis Johnson. It's a moving portrait of a man called Robert Granger, played by the great Joel Edgerton, whose life kind of unfolds during an era of unprecedented change in the early 20th century of America. Robert's orphaned as a young age and he grows into adulthood among the towering forests of the Pacific Northwest, where he helps expand the railroad empire as a kind of logger alongside men as unforgettable as the landscapes they inhabit. After a tender courtship, he marries Gladys, played by Felicity Jones, and they build a home together, though his work often takes him from her and their young daughter. His life takes an unexpected turn and Robert finds, I suppose, beauty, brutality and newfound meaning in the forests of the trees that he had been felling for the railroad. It's kind of an ode to a vanishing way of life and an ever-evolving world and its possibilities. It's kind of like the story of an ordinary man in extraordinary times, and Edgerton is absolutely brilliant in it. It was co-written by Greg Quaidar, who we spoke to last year for the beautiful film Sing Sing. There's a couple of great actors alongside Joel Edgerton in this. We've William H. Macy, who's this talkative old-timer who's in charge of kind of unsafe explosives in all this logging. We've Kerry Condon playing this insightful forestry worker who's there to kind of log and take note of all the trees. And she comes into the movie later on. Felicity Jones is great as his wife. This is a gorgeous film. It's getting rave reviews. There's Oscar talk. It's a slow movie, but it's a beautiful film. as I say, Felicity Jones, Oscar nominee, who's been in everything from Theory of Everything to recently The Brutalist, plays Robert's wife in this. And Kerry Condon, our own wonderful actress from Tipperary, who was, of course, nominated for an Oscar for Banshees of Inisherin, and we recently saw her in F1. So I got to talk to the brilliant actresses that are Kerry Condon and Felicity Jones about their roles in Train Dreams. Hi, Kerry. Hi, Felicity. How are you? Sorry about that awkward. I couldn't say hello to you till they started recording. So, Felicity, you know, Joel's character and your character, they're kind of extraordinary, ordinary people in a way. They're not history makers, yet their lives are huge in some ways. That was kind of the message I was taking in this movie. I know it sounds like a grand philosophical question, but that every life has huge value, no matter if you make history or you're just watching history. But you tell me.
Absolutely. It feels as though they are contributing to the making of history. And as you say, the film is a portrait of every human life, in a sense, because ultimately every life has a value and every life has a story, and life throws you curveballs and life has ups and downs, and the film is an exploration of huge themes of life and death and meaning.
Kerry, your character's, you know, almost like a Buddhist or something in it. She's the most centered, maybe, and that it's like life can throw you terrible shots, but you can find a way to figure out how to integrate them and get on with it. But again, you tell me, how do you see her?
So, you know, in the voiceover, it says that she was a nurse in the war, you know, kind of gives you a bit of her backstory. And then she says about she had a husband that died. So there was a kind of a life lived. And then obviously being a nurse in the war, she would have seen so much hardship or whatever. So that kind of brought me to where she was at when she meets him. And then also in those towers, Clint had kind of given me a lot of research and the women who worked in those towers, like they'd be there for months. So if you're going to sit up in a tower for months and end on your own, you're going to have to be pretty zen to like get through it. So yeah. I feel like she was just kind of further along with dealing with grief than Robert, Joel's character. And had a kind of, like you said, like a zen-like quality to it all. And kind of content in her own mind a bit. To be up in a tower for months and end, you know.
Yeah, she was like a lighthouse keeper almost, you know, I was thinking.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind that job in real life.
And it sounds really nice.
I know.
And
even if you went mad, you wouldn't even know, right?
Just pottering around.
Yeah. Felicity, I was trying to figure out who the lovely small child is in it you have, and I couldn't find it in a production notes because my wife watched this with me and kept going, and me too, but we were both so taken with the little, the baby and then the girl. Who was she? Because she was great.
Well, they were twins. So there were two little girls, and depending on, you know, there's all sorts of rules about working hours and things like that.
Yeah.
So we use different little girl depending on the scene, but also they had quite different temperaments. So depending on what was needed from the scene, then it would be one twin or the other. But as you say, I mean, they were just so just cute. Brilliant casting, just very, very, I mean, children can't be anything but in the moment. You can't even say they were so in the moment while they're children. You know, that's how they are.
They were
but
full
I think it
method.
Was infectious. Yeah, I think it was infectious for Joel and I being around them, because all those scenes just have to capture a luminescence and a life and a vibrancy.
Yeah. Kerry, is it true? I mean, it's in the production notes, so it must be, but this was a happy dovetailing of events for you, because you're currently, or you have just finished, planting a forest. You were planting trees yourself where you live.
I mean, a forest is a bit of a stretch, you know, like.
They're very impressive.
I know, no.
Some trees.
There is a forest and I'm adding to the forest. And yeah, I don't want to sound like an elitist person harping on about trees, you know, when some people can't even make rent. But for the sake of the movie.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm big into trees and I feel like trees should have rights, actually. I think like trees over like 200 years old, 500 years old, I think you shouldn't be allowed butcher down a tree. Mm. And so I that was a big draw for me in the movie. I'm fascinated with trees and you know how they communicate underground and all this crazy stuff that we're learning about trees. And so I have a farm and I'm like planting a few trees.
Okay, sorry, I overstated it with the forest.
I mean, I'd love to plant a forest. I hope in my lifetime that I can do something like that. Yeah. But that was one of the reasons I wanted to make the movie because of that theme.
Yeah, great. And Felicity, you know, she's your character Gladys is like 100 years old or slightly more at this stage. How did you kind of find her voice in every sense of the phrase when it? You want to play someone faithfully, but it's a long time ago and it's a different world.
I found it's a combination of the book I found incredibly helpful for giving me some of those that interiority of Gladys. Mm. And then also reading about pioneer women and women who'd been in Gladys's situation. And there was a particular woman who had been a single parent, her husband had died, and it was her and her daughter living, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And she was quite an extraordinary character. And they'd go on trips into the wilderness in the middle of winter and put up a tent and be out in the thick snow. And there was a lot of, it's a diary and it's a lot of her fishing and feeding her and her daughter and then she talks a lot. She was really into coffee. She was obsessed with coffee. Yeah. So she's always and that's a big ritual. That's a big part of her day is preparing the coffee in the morning. And I was thinking, actually, people don't change that much. You know, as you say, it's 100 years ago, but we all still love having our morning coffee. Yeah.
And the routine of it. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Ritual.
Yes, exactly. Kerry, the last thing I saw you in was a very different movie called F1. And on this side of the water, away from America, I know you're in London, but in terms of where that movie was made, lots of people like me and other people who write about movies and think about movies were kind of quietly delighted that it was your accent for a movie that was so big and blockbustery. There you were talking just like yourself. I know you were acting and everything. Was that negotiated or like, did you go in and say, this is what I'm doing? Or did they say, be whoever you want?
They didn't say be whoever you want. I think it was just more like F1 is such an international sport, you know, naturally. Mm. And so it was just more showing that. So when I was cast, it was just in my own accent. I mean, they did encourage me to use more words than were in the script. Like I was encouraged to use lads and phrases that I would use in my own life that weren't in the script. They did suggest those things. But I loved the way they had like loads of different nationalities and loads of different accents in a way that was really not trying to be that were like not forced. It was just that's naturally how it is. There's all different nationalities. Mm-hmm. And also Bernie Collins was who I kind of learned a lot from. And Bernie's from Ireland and she's a real life strategist. So it was like easy to just follow that lead.
Yeah. Felicity may not understand that when we use lads, we can mean men or women. So you can explain that to her after I'm gone. So
I know.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you, lads. The film's terrific, by the way.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. So nice to see you both and continued success.
Thanks so much.
Lovely. Cheers, thank you very much.
Bye. Kerry Condon there talking about keeping her accent in F1. And you also heard Felicity Jones there, who are both in the beautiful film Train Dreams. And that is now on Netflix for your viewing pleasure. Beautiful film. It looks beautiful. It's, as I say, a kind of ode to a vanishing way of life, you know. And there's something, even though it's very different to Ireland, you know, I don't know. I think it might speak to Irish audiences. Maybe. You'll have to watch it to find out, won't you? And as I say, it is on Netflix now. And Chris Wasser will be with us after the break. He'll be telling us what he thought of Train Dreams, but he'll also be telling us about the return of Wicked. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. We turn to the week's new cinema releases, and chief among them is Wicked for Good. Yes, Wicked is back. We knew it was coming back because part one ended right around this time last year, very much on a stay tuned for part two. I didn't get to see it, however, erstwhile film critic, entertainment journalist, arts critic. He's just critical of everything. Chris Wasser has been to see it and he joins me now. Chris, hi, how are you?
John, I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. So listen, this was massive at the time. 10 Oscar noms, I think it was. It kind of brought people who hadn't been to the cinema back to the cinema. I remember my daughter going to it with lots of pals. I think they might have even dressed up. This was a big deal at the time.
It was massive, and it brought people, it certainly brought a lot of people who maybe hadn't been to the cinema in a long time back into, you know, the pictures. And it was a sort of like bona fide pop culture phenomenon that you just cannot predict, you know, up there with the likes of Barbie and Oppenheimer, where people were going to see it a second and a third time. It dominated award season. Some people kind of raised their eyebrows about that, but I believe that in some respects, at least when, as far as the actors are concerned, it deserved this. You know, best actress for Ariana Grande, best supporting actress for Cynthia Erivo, or it might have been the other way around, so I apologize if I'm getting that wrong, but performance-wise, it was something else, and it also made an absolute fortune. I mean, it cost about $150 million to make, and it turned over about $750 million at the box office. So it was an enormous commercial, and to an extent, critical success. I think some of the flaws that I might have pointed out this time last year were based around this idea of the film being split into two. So you had this idea where they were going to give us two films. It's a 150 minute stage musical, you know, and there's only a 20 minute break, you know, when you go see it on the stage in Broadway or West End. But what they wanted to do was, you know, leave us hanging for a year. And for some reason, the length of the first film, just the first part, John, was 10 minutes longer than the entire stage show. So I found kind of a fault with that. So you had this film that sort of like dragged out certain story elements, felt like a little at times like, you know, the story's being played out in slow motion. Visually, you know, that kind of gaudy, candy-colored sort of aesthetic didn't really work all that well. I just felt, why are we spreading this over two films when it could be one great film? So that was my concern going into the sequel, that we might have already done it. Yeah.
Yeah, now I should mention, and I think I said this at the time, I didn't see it the week it came out, but I saw it not long after that. And I'm, you know, flying in the face of the wind here, and I'm sorry to say it, and maybe I'm not the target audience, but I just didn't get what it was all about. I mean, one or two nice songs in it, but I was underwhelmed, yeah. I have to say. And I just want to state that, you know, in case... I don't know why. let it be known that I didn't get it. But look, that's neither here nor there. But for the uninitiated, I suppose, and we'll get on now to Wicked for Good, but this whole story is kind of a prequel to The Wizard of Oz, right?
Yes, it serves as both a prequel and in some respects, definitely with this film, a sequel to The Wizard of Oz. So I think if you're in any way, you know, the uninitiated would do very well to familiarize themselves with the Wicked's backstory before they go into the second one. In other words, you need to have seen the first film before you watch the second. But the first one covered pretty much the basics. It's this, you know, very, you know, it's this comical tale of this goody two-shoes spellcaster named Glinda, played by Ariana Grande, and her old college roommate in Oz, this green-skinned sorceress named Elphaba, played by Cynthia Erivo. And the first film sort of covered the basics. Their, you know, initial meeting and bumpy friendship, you know, their roommates in college, Shiz University, where all aspiring witches and sorcerers go to study. You had a conflicted love interest. There's always a Prince Charming in these things. It's Jonathan Bailey as Prince Fierro. You explored certainly, if not Glinda's family background, Elphaba's, and this tragic familial twist, you know, how, you know, she was sort of born into a family, you know, no one else in her family had green skin, and she was sort of like an outcast as a result result of that, not just at the school, but in our entire community. You also had a villainous headmistress played by Michelle Yeoh, that's Madame Morrible, and this very jazzy Aussie wizard, Jeff Goldblum, fully switched on, giving a full Goldblum, who has this not so wonderful plan concerning the talking animals of Oz. So a stuffed first part, but all you need to know is that at the end of it, Elphaba in particular, everyone has, but Elphaba is just shocked by the wizard's plan to literally silence the talking animals of Oz. She's not having any of this, and because she's going against the, you know, the wonderful wizard, she's considered a traitor. And, you know, the wizard and Madame Morrible, they get their flying monkeys after her, and she, you know, flies off into the distance, presumably never to be seen again. Spoiler alert, she's back. Not just that, she's also public enemy number one in Oz. And a year or two has passed, and in that time you have Glinda, her former bestie, has become the wizard's spokeswoman in Oz, because, you know, the thing about the wizard is he never really shows his face. You have Prince Fierro, who is now engaged to be married to Glinda. He's also been appointed captain of the wizard's guard, and his only job, John, is to basically find Elphaba and bring her to justice. But he doesn't want to do that, because, another spoiler here, he's in love with Elphaba. He's engaged to be married to her best friend, but he's really in love with this witch. So Morrible kind of knows what's going on, and that, you know, Fierro is starting to kind of question his feelings. So she devises this wicked plan, and I won't say any more after this sentence, to change the weather. And in doing that, that might bring about some little tornado that will bring about a house from Kansas. You can see where I'm going with this, John.
Yes, yes. Now, as you describe it there, that doesn't sound that bad.
It doesn't sound that bad, but, you know, and it doesn't sound that complicated. there's always a but. Look, I think the first half, I think actually going back to the original stage version and to explain the hoopla about Wicked, I think a lot of that hoopla is based on people loving the original stage show. And I was one of those. And I think the first act of the stage show, so the stage show is based on a 1995 novel by Gregory Maguire, which is, of course, inspired by the original Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And then the musical by Stephen Schwartz and Winnie Holtzman just took all of those stories and came up with something new. So it's this, and I thought the first act of the musical was about as perfect a musical presentation as you could hope for. It's very, very funny. The songs, you know, popular, Defying Gravity, they are instantly memorable. You just need one blast of those songs and you think to yourself, that's a classic. And you know, the story was very well told. I even thought when I went to see the musical that the second act, despite the fact that if you provide a synopsis like the one I just did there, it sounds very simple, it does get complicated. And it's not as fun, it's not as playful as the first. The songs are weaker in the second act. It takes itself far too seriously. And it comes with an unfortunate Dorothy problem. And what I mean by that is, there comes a point in this film where after the weather changes and after the house crash lands in Munchkinland, you're introduced, well, in the background, because all you ever see is shadows, you know, a flick of that famous blue dress or the slippers or, you know, the Cowardly Lion. It's all sort of, you know, on the periphery. Once you introduce that part of the story, it becomes impossible for the viewer to kind of think about anything else. It's like, so watching the second half of the second part of Wicked is a little bit like trying to have a conversation with a friend when you're out somewhere and all you can hear is the conversation at the table next to you. You keep asking, you keep saying to yourself, but the Dorothy story's over there and that's way better than what's happening here. It's very, very strange. Yeah, so the film is like constantly wrestling with itself. It's like, we can't remake The Wizard of Oz, but we can't pretend that it's not happening either. So all of that gets very jumbled, very confusing.
Of course, they might be making some philosophical Platonic point there about, you know, reality just being flickering shadows on the wall. Or maybe not. Maybe the wicked people had no idea of that whatsoever when they were making this. But tell me this, even though I said I, you know, wasn't wild about the first one.
Yeah.
Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo were great in it. And Cynthia Erivo with her prosthetic makeup was brilliant and a beguiling presence on screen. Are they up to form in this one as well?
And I'm still trying to get my head around that description. I think you've thought about it more than the filmmakers thought about it. No, they are terrific here. Grande is delightful. And for me, it was a revelation in the first Wicked, because I never really ranked her as an actor before. And that was my mistake. She was wonderful in that last film. Cynthia Erivo is just head and shoulders above the rest. And the two of them here have this wonderful chemistry, this wonderful charisma between them and also separately. What they're doing is just leagues ahead of everyone else. There is the slight feeling, though, that they are sort of performing the same, you know, excuse the terrible pun, magic trick that we saw last time around. And like all great magic tricks, the first time you see it is a knockout. The second time, you sort of know what's coming. So it is familiar territory for them. But at the same time, again, so far ahead of the pack. For some performers, that's not necessarily their fault. I think Jonathan Bailey's character here, he doesn't really get much of a look in, which is a shame because, you know, he, like Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo, when he's honest, he does light up the screen. We certainly saw that in the first film. We don't get to see much of it here. Then with the supporting players, Jeff Goldblum just about got away with, you know, well, I mean, latter-day Jeff Goldblum performances, I always wonder where Jeff Goldblum begins and the character and it ends and the character begins. It's just, it gets a bit confusing. And here he's overdoing it just slightly. Michelle Yeoh is just uncharacteristically awful here, John. Like, that she is such an extraordinary actor on her best day, and I've been trying to figure out what's gone wrong here, and I've been even like having conversations with my partner on and off throughout the year, because she's just seen the first one, she hasn't seen this one, and we both kind of talked at one stage about this idea that maybe she is on a different page to the others in terms of she's in sort of a stagey pantomime mode, and the other performers remember that this is not the stage version, this is a film. But she's stuck, and that might be it. And unfortunately, that doesn't work when everyone else is taking the material seriously. They're taking it a bit too seriously in this film, but it's just, it's so wooden. It's so, you know, out of tune. I was quite surprised at her performance, to be honest.
Now, it has to be said, from what I've read, this is, again, dividing people. Last week, we were talking about The Running Man, and although a lot of people hated that, there were some great reviews of it as well. This is similar. I've seen 4 and 5 star reviews. I've seen much less than that. So the jury's out. What about your jury? What are you going to say stars wise?
I have seen some very positive reviews for it and some very harsh reviews for it. But I did not have a good time with it. I also didn't enjoy, and this is a problem again, this is a fundamental problem with the stage show, this need to over-explain and fill in every gap and answer every question, even the questions you never asked. How did the Yellow Brick Road, where did the Yellow Brick Road come from? Who built it? That's, this film answers it. Where did the Tin Man come from? The Cowardly Lion? Was it the Scarecrow Without a Brain? This film answers all three questions. There comes a point, John, where it's like, well, where's the mystery gone? You're draining all of the magic from these wonderful timeless stories if you explain every mystery and look under every rock. I don't like that, and I think that is a problem with contemporary franchise filmmaking. I would like to see less of it. I just think that this film needed a sense of humor. It needed a shot of energy, a splash of self-awareness. It needed the songs and the wit and the enthusiasm of the first film. It doesn't have that, so it's 2 stars.
And tell me this, and to mix metaphors here, you know, they often, some people say, and it's heresy for some people, but, you know, if the Beatles had have made one single album instead of a double album for the White Album, you would have had one amazing album. I kind of agree with that. I know some Beatles fans would go mad by the suggestion, but should they have done that here? Should the 300 minutes just been, I don't know, 2 hours or whatever? Like, should they just have made one film is what I'm trying to say.
I think so. Look, I did scoff at this idea. Remember, there was this big, you know, there was this fancy letter that John M. Chu, the director, came out with a couple of years back where he said that in order to fully respect the story and to give it, you know, everything it deserves on the big screen, we decided to split it in two. And I just thought, well, there's no need for that. But I understand that he wanted to flesh some things out and that you can't just have a little bit of dialogue and then song, a little bit of dialogue. Things work different. It's a different medium entirely. But I think rather than a 300-minute film franchise based on a 2.5-hour musical, you could have made an extraordinary 3-hour big screen event, one and done, and it could have been brilliant. But unfortunately, that would have made less money than 2 films, John. So this is how Hollywood works. So I think they've ruined their chances. You could have had just an absolute classic musical here. Instead, you've one half decent film and one bad film.
Okay, well, 2 stars for Wicked, which is in cinemas from this Friday. You know, when directors sit down to write letters to audiences, it's probably not a great sign. But anyway, we better take a quick clip of Wicked for good and give listeners a flavor.
You can wave that wand all you want, but you have no real power.
I'm a public figure now. People expect me to fly. Be encouraging.
You can't resist this.
Who could?
You know who could.
There's a house, and it's flying through the sky. I'm off to see the wizard.
Bring me the room of the Wicked Witch of the West. So I have proof that she's dead.
Stop this. It's gone too far. Elphaba, they're coming for you. Just look at me. Not with your eyes, with theirs.
That's a clip from Wicked for Good, which is now in cinemas, which Chris Wasser gave 2 stars to. And look, it will be everywhere. Anywhere that has a screen, I imagine, is showing it. And I'm sure, despite the lukewarm review here on Screen Time, it's still going to pack them in. Now, Chris, before the break, I was talking to Kerry Condon and Felicity Jones about Train Dreams. I really enjoyed the film. Listeners have heard all about it and kind of know what it's about. But so we don't need to go back through the plot and all. But what did you make of it? I gathered you really liked it.
I thought it was exceptional. One of the best films I've seen this year. So good, in fact, that I will be going out to pick up a copy of Dennis Johnson's original novella this week. I loved that this film just has its own rhythm, its own sort of storybook-like quality. Normally, I complain about narration and explaining things that don't need to be explained, but I thought Will Patton's contribution, you know, just in the background, you never see him, was just beautiful. I enjoyed the fact that this is a film that only ever talks when it's absolutely necessary, and that you have these starry supporting players. They're such small roles for William H. Macy and Kerry Condon and various others like Felicity Jones to play, but it's not about the size of the role, it's about the impact that role can have. And then I think at the center of it all, I mean, you can give all the love in the world to William H. Macy and Kerry Condon, and they deserve it for their performances here, but it's Robert's Tale and it's Joel Edgerton's film. And I just think the director and Edgerton, they've just created this beautiful portrait of a man who is just, you know, as you would have explained there, he's had this life that's been decorated by immense beauty and unimaginable heartache. And that's to tell a story about an entire life is a very difficult thing to do on screen, but these guys make it look easy. And I thought Edgerton was just so, it's just such a stunning performance. Other actors would have just, you know, done too much with their face or said too much. It's just the right amount. This is the best that I've seen of them, I think.
So what would you say stars-wise for Train Dreams?
Oh, I loved it. I think it'll have to be the full 5. You know, I was watching it and thinking Terrence Malick used to make films like this, and they just took my...
He doesn't anymore, but Shinsuke Alela.
Certainly doesn't, but when he was on form, he used to take my breath away, and that's exactly what this film did. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what the director Clint Bentley does next, and I would love to see Joel Edgerton's name in the award season conversation.
Yeah, well, we watch this space. Well, folks, in case you didn't believe me, Chris Wasser has given Train Dreams 5 stars, and he doesn't give them out often. He also gave Wicked, not 5 stars, but 2 stars, Wicked for Good, which is in cinemas, and Train Dreams is now on Netflix. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there reviewing Wicked and giving his 2 cents on Train Dreams, which he loved. He loved Wicked less. He gave it 2 stars. It's called Wicked for Good, incidentally. And it's in your local cinema, by golly. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'll be talking to Sydney Sweeney about her role in the new boxing movie, Christie. Well, it's a lot more than a boxing movie. Tune in next week for that. If you want to get in touch with me about anything you've been watching on the big or small screen or anything at all, you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk Radio. Going to leave you with some music from the TV this week. And from Ted Lasso, I'm going to play Waterfall by the Stone Roses to mark the sad passing of the legend that was Manny, their bass player, who sadly left us on Thursday at the age of 63. So this is for all the Stone Roses fans out there. And of course, for Manny, who I met once, who we interviewed once a long time ago
on the Tom Dunn Show. And he was a legend, as are the Stone Roses. So I will leave you with Waterfall from Ted Lasso by the great Stone Roses, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend. Chimes and Sunday.